Welcome to Drive Time Specialty, a podcast exclusively for healthcare professionals. A spotlight on hepatic encephalopathy.
Liver disease is one of the leading causes of premature deaths in Australia. Acute decompensation of chronic liver disease, characterised by, for example, jaundice, ascites or hepatic encephalopathy, is a common reason for presentation of patients to the emergency department and hospitalisation and can lead to prolonged and recurrent hospitalisations. Cirrhosis leaves patients vulnerable to serious complications, so timely diagnosis is important to guide treatment, determine prognosis and monitor for complications in patients with chronic liver disease. Early recognition of patients at risk of decompensation, as well as continuation of care on discharge from hospital, are both strategies to interrupt the revolving door phenomenon in caring for patients with chronic liver disease. My name's Mayur Garg, I'm the Director of Gastroenterology at Northern Health, and I am very privileged and honoured to be with Professor James O'Byrn, a consultant gastroenterologist at Sunshine Coast University Hospital, and Associate Professor Avik Majumdar, a transplant hepatologist at Austin Health, both of whom have been involved in several Gastroenterological Society of Australia guidelines and consensus statements over the years, including the decompensated cirrhosis care bundle. We're going to review chronic liver disease and its complications in a tertiary setting, what we should be aiming for, and what are the challenges and practical tips to overcome these challenges. Welcome to you both, James and Avik.
Hi there.
Hi, Maya. Hi, Avik.
James, can you just give us a brief outline as to what sorts of complications can occur in our patients with chronic liver disease or cirrhosis that require them to present to hospital?
Really, there can be many and varied, but the commonest reason why people present to hospital when they decompensate from their chronic liver disease is actually with the development of ascites, fluid retention in the abdomen. And this happens really quite suddenly, and often people come to the ED and end up admitted. It's really important that they are admitted and assessed thoroughly because they can obviously present 10% of them with bacterial peritonitis. So it's really important that they get a very early diagnostic tap on as soon as possible and after arrival. After that, the other common presentation of decompensated cirrhosis is with bleeding. And this is not always portal hypertension related, but oftentimes, especially in alcohol-related liver disease, we see a lot of patients presenting with bleeding from esophagitis. Then, of course, patients present with hepatic encephalopathy. And this is often the first presentation of their decompensation. I think it's important to say that a lot of patients who present to hospital, their decompensation, be it through ascites, jaundice, bleeding, or hepatic encephalopathy, or even sepsis, it's often their first presentation, the first recognition that they have underlying liver disease. And the importance of decompensation is that it shortens your life expectancy considerably in the course of your natural history of liver disease. Most people who remain compensated will have a life expectancy or a median overall survival of 12 to 16 years. But once you decompensate, the life expectancy is dramatically shortened, and a lot of patients, unfortunately, who present with decompensated liver disease may not even survive 5 years. So in our practice, and we audited this in our hospital, it's definitely ascites that presents most commonly, and then bleeding, sepsis, and hepatic encephalopathy are also important presentations.
Thanks very much, James. I want to focus a little bit on hepatic encephalopathy now. Avik, so it can be quite subtle. Can you just tell me what the main signs are? How you see patients with encephalopathy presenting to hospital?
So encephalopathy does present with a number of varied features, as you've mentioned. And really, we use two broad categorizations, and they are covert encephalopathy, which is really encephalopathy that can't be diagnosed accurately at the bedside, but you can have sort of non-specific signs, particularly your patients talk about a fog, brain fog particularly, or clouding of their normal cognitive state. And that can develop into mood changes, apathy, sleep-wake reversal are often common early signs of encephalopathy. To truly establish whether it's covert encephalopathy is often beyond the realm of the clinic, as it involves complex neuropsychiatric testing to make an accurate diagnosis. But they're the kind of things that patients start to talk about as they've had their diagnosis of chronic liver disease, or they might in retrospect describe after being diagnosed with chronic liver disease in the first instance. So from there, things progress to overt encephalopathy, and this is what you can pick up in the clinic on a readily basis. And that's, to this audience, sounding for a hepatic flap is a common way to pick that up. But obviously, the symptoms get more severe into drowsiness, confusion, disorientation, right up until coma. The other thing that can be useful in this spectrum is bedside tests. This is when we see sort of abnormalities, particularly it's more of a neuropraxia, so you find executive functioning and planning impaired, and you get a constructive apraxia. So things like drawing a clock face or a five-sided pentagram or connecting numbers together on a trail-making test, things that are impaired. A very simple and easy-to-use test that is readily available to everyone is the animal naming test. Basically, you ask a patient to name as many animals they can within 1 minute, cutoff being 15 to be the, you know, the normal amount. They're allowed, you know, more than one animal from the same species. So under dogs, you could say a Cocker Spaniel or German Shepherd, that still counts as two animals. And that is something that's surprisingly quite accurate and quite reproducible across many observers. And it doesn't rely upon a standardized test like the psychometric hepatic encephalopathy score, which has been validated overseas. It's a very difficult test to actually administer in the clinic. The other thing that you can use is the Stroop test, and that's an app that's available, and that involves patients logging into the app and initially a barrage of two tests, assigning numbers and colours to the correct app. Again, it's very easy to do, but does require people to have some schooling and some ability to persist with the test. It can be a bit challenging at times, and you know, if you're already fatigued from not sleeping well and you have to do these on repetitive measures, it can be hard for patients to do that regularly. But certainly the animal naming test is something that I use quite often. The other thing to mention is, are there any blood-based markers? And ammonia is something that constantly comes up in the conversation. It does have its utility in certain circumstances, but in general, a serum ammonia level taken in the clinic often does not correlate very well with the degree or severity of encephalopathy. But it's not something that I use routinely in my practice, although it does have prognostic value. So there's some recent studies from the UK that shows that measuring a serum ammonia, and if it is elevated, it does increase your risk of hospitalisation and mortality. But in terms of its direct correlation with, as I mentioned, the degree or severity of encephalopathy, that's where things tend to fall apart. James, I don't know if you've got an opinion on ammonia.
Well, I have an opinion on ammonia, but I just wanted to add something to what you said, is that you make it sound very easy, Avik, to diagnose hepatic encephalopathy, but in reality, it's often quite difficult, especially in some of our older patients who've got diabetes. They might have microvascular disease of the brain. They may, you know, often when they present to ED, they may be intoxicated. And I think it can be actually a bit more tricky to discern what's encephalopathy versus another presentation with confusion or, you know, impaired cognition. And I think that I would just alert people to be conscious of being able to diagnose hepatic encephalopathy, but also keep a broad differential of what else may be going on. And that's especially pertinent to some of our patients with alcohol-related liver disease who are prone to frequent falls, may have low platelet counts, and may actually have subdural hematomas as a cause for their presentation with confusion. So I think it's important to think about hepatic encephalopathy as a cause of impaired cognition in patients with chronic liver disease, but also to bear in mind that there can be a wide differential as well.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that I certainly glossed over is it is important to assess these patients neurologically. Encephalopathy typically does not have any lateralizing neurology. So I think that's something to always bear in mind.
Yeah. So quite commonly, these patients, when they come to emergencies, would end up scoring themselves a CT brain. Is that something that you see over-ordered perhaps in this setting, or is it something you'd encourage when there's any doubt?
I would definitely encourage it. But just to feed back to what Avik said about ammonia, I think ammonia doesn't help you in the diagnosis in that scenario. So if somebody presents to ED, they may have encephalopathy and they might have a very modestly elevated or even rarely a normal ammonia. And likewise, there are plenty of people wandering around with cirrhosis who are unimpaired, who have high levels of ammonia. It's true what Avik said, that there is this study that shows that ammonia as a standalone test seems to predict a poor outcome. But then you could argue the same goes for bilirubin, INR, and other common biomarkers that we use. So I think that a CT brain, I certainly have a low threshold.
And I'll certainly second that.
Excellent. So once we've got a patient we've diagnosed with hepatic encephalopathy, what do you do for them? What treatments do you offer?
So once the diagnosis is made, it depends on the severity. I think the standard way of treating encephalopathy, whether it's overt or covert, is to start off with lactulose. And then now with the availability of rifaximin, we try and use that early if we can. They have to obviously meet the correct prescribing criteria. So that's encephalopathy despite adequate dosing with lactulose. The basis of dosing for lactulose is meant to be 2 to 3 soft bowel motions per day. The rationale behind it is to change the or the conversion of ammonia to ammonium in the small bowel and alter the pH. However, it's really the cathartic function of lactulose.
And in terms of prevention of recurrence, is this an ongoing therapy that we'd be using in the longer term and titrate to the bowel actions? And then I guess when somebody does have recurrence, introducing rifaximin in, is that something that you continue in the longer term?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's two things. It's one is monitoring your treatment. Often caregivers are an excellent source of information in terms of how effective urine cephalopathy therapy is. And then early initiation of rifaximin is certainly important. I guess one of the things I didn't really talk about there is nutrition. And nutrition is, again, a very important part of encephalopathy management. The main reason for that is that skeletal muscle is another place where ammonia is metabolized. It's not just in the liver itself. And so if you're sarcopenic, then the risk of encephalopathy increases, the risk of recurrent encephalopathy increases, and the risk of hospitalization actually increases. So that is something that is certainly important. And the old teaching used to be about protein restriction to reduce the amount of nitrogenous waste produced in the gut, but that's certainly not the case. In fact, you know, everyone should be on a high-energy, high-protein diet, particularly to treat sarcopenia and minimize the risk of encephalopathy. There's also some evidence for micronutrients and branched-chain amino acids, but that's not very strong. And certainly, the strongest evidence base is indeed with rifaximin for those recurrent HE patients.
Now, of course, along with treating with lactulose and or rifaximin, we also often need to consider the actual precipitant for them coming in with encephalopathy. So, James, can I just get you to outline your approach in that setting? What sort of precipitants do you see and what do you do about them?
Often when people present acutely with hepatic encephalopathy, there's often a clear precipitant. And if you think about the central role of ammonia, even though it's not useful as a biomarker, it certainly has a key role in the pathogenesis of hepatic encephalopathy, then you can think about what might be precipitating the syndrome. And the clear precipitants really are constipation, dehydration, infection, and GI bleeding. All of those lead to an increase in ammonia delivery to the brain. So, for instance, we know that bacterial actions on the colonic contents generates ammonia. And so clearly, if you're constipated, there's more time for the colonic contents to remain in the colon, and that leads to more ammonia generation. If you're dehydrated, it's important to remember that 10% of your body's ammonia is excreted by the kidneys. So simple dehydration can lead to a critical increase in ammonia load in the body. And likewise, if you're infected, that generates systemic inflammation, which increases ammonia delivery to the brain. And if you've had a GI bleed, then your gut is full of protein, which obviously generates nitrogenous compounds, which contribute to ammonia generation. So I often teach the juniors that really it's a very belt and braces approach to somebody presenting with acute hepatic encephalopathy, and that's treat dehydration, have a low threshold for treating infection, make sure they're not constipated, and look for GI bleeding. And generally, you won't go wrong with that approach. And I would never criticize any junior doctor who started broad-spectrum antibiotics on somebody who presented acutely with HE, even in the absence of obvious infection.
There are a group of patients who come in again and again with encephalopathy to hospital, obviously. At what stage would you then, in the absence of finding any other precipitant, go on and look for example, shunts in the abdomen and do imaging for that?
That's a very good question. If the problem is recurrent and there's no overt precipitant, then my practice is to certainly look for a spontaneous portosystemic shunt. Often that's a splenorenal shunt or something that's very easily seen. There may be some clues in the history, in the full blood count, someone who's got portal hypertension with a normal platelet count, and whose spleen isn't that big, they may indeed have a splenorenal shunt. If they've got gastric varices, again, that's another telltale sign there may be a portosystemic shunt. And the evidence for embolizing these is actually quite compelling. And certainly in our practice, if patients have a low MELD score who aren't heading towards transplant, who have a history of readmissions for encephalopathy, despite optimal medical management and nutritional management, they're the people that we consider candidates for shunt embolization. And it can make quite a significant difference in preventing hospitalization. I guess when you're embarking on looking for these shunts and considering people for embolization, you do have to think about the bigger picture and whether transplantation is required, because there is a chance that the embolization may not be successful, or you may open up new collateral vessels that cause portosystemic shunting.
Now, both of you have worked on the chronic liver disease bundle that's available via the Gastroenterological Society of Australia website. It provides a nice little overview and checklist of the different sorts of complications that can occur in the initial management. You're both working at fairly experienced liver centres. But I'd just like you to perhaps introduce this bundle and see how it can be used in the general setting across different hospitals across Australia.
We came up with the care bundle in the UK mainly because there was a big, what we call an NCPOD report, which is a national confidential inquiry into hospital deaths. And we identified that in lots of hospitals in the UK that didn't have a hepatology service or a specialised hepatology service, patients, and often young patients, were dying of complications of liver disease needlessly, essentially. So Basel and the BSG, that's the British Association of the Study of the Liver and the British Society of Gastroenterology, collaborated on this very simple checklist of things that are evidence-based that can be done in the first 48 hours of that admission that really don't need to be driven by a specialist hepatology service. They can be done by any general medical team. And they're really simple things like checking for sepsis, looking for renal dysfunction, making sure patients are adequately hydrated, checking for bleeding, doing a diagnostic tap, importantly, looking for and treating hepatic encephalopathy, and then importantly, in patients who've been identified as having hepatic encephalopathy, making sure they're discharged on appropriate prophylaxis, because that's really important to prevent readmission. And, you know, lactulose is our mainstay, but rifaximin to prevent readmission is a really important feature of this. So we deployed the care bundle and it's been used. I would say some hospitals really used it quite a lot, some not so much. But when it was studied, it definitely was shown to improve hospital outcome and prevent readmissions.
So based on the success, or at least in the published success of the UK Care Bundle, we adopted a similar strategy here in Australia. The GISA Care Bundle is available online as a PDF, so you can just print it out as is. We've also got it as an editable Word document, so you could link into your local antibiotic protocol or massive transfusion requirement protocol. So there's spaces there, so each individual health service can tailor it to their needs. It's also adaptable to digital care records. So, you know, for example, in Cerner, we've developed a module at the Austin, so it can be used in the ED. And I think the key message is that the bundle actually provides a list of those precipitants to look for, decompensation. As James has mentioned, those common precipitants and the management of them, and that includes even transfusion requirements in GI bleeding, and then what needs to be done next. So what are the baseline investigations as well in those first 24 hours, which is really the highest mortality risk period. And then after that, hopefully, in most centres, they'll have a specialist gastroenterology opinion within that 24-hour period to take the rest of the management forward. In the UK, as James has also alluded to, there has been a discharge care bundle, and I know this has been studied in Australia, in Western Sydney, and certainly discharge care is extremely important, and this must vary as well from centre to centre, but in terms of making sure a patient has a liver clinic appointment when they leave, regular medication prescribing and making sure a supply is evident. That we have a particular issue with rifaximin because it's often seen as just another antibiotic when it clearly is not. And so that's another area that we've noticed in the clinic across the board that patients are missing out or the antibiotic stopped at the end of the packet. And by the time they come back to the clinic, that's when the issue's picked up. And really, you know, to a GP, sometimes rifaximin just looks like another post-discharge medicine rather than a specific therapy for encephalopathy. So a discharge bundle captures a lot of those things that do go by the wayside, especially in an increased pressured health system. We've not yet developed that at a GISA level, but it's something that we're certainly looking into. And again, in the UK, they've gone that one step further to look at the chronic liver disease clinic checklist as well. And that's something else that we may explore.
That's fantastic. Congratulations to both of you. That's great work. One thing I wanted to, I guess, come back to is that the care of patients with chronic liver disease is clearly very complex. I'd like you to just outline briefly how you bring the rest of your multidisciplinary team into the care of these patients, because clearly it's not something that can be just handled by us as medical clinicians.
I'm going to lead into the discussion about the role of the multidisciplinary team by just stating that I think that readmissions are the Achilles heel of hepatology. We're dealing with very physiologically unstable patients. And the pressure on public hospitals, certainly at the moment, to get people out of hospital is such that we're often discharging patients just when they're on that trajectory of starting to improve. And that's where I think linking into nurses, either in the community or within the hospital, who can follow up those patients very quickly. Because let's be honest, it's very, very difficult to see these patients in an outpatient clinic within 1 to 2 weeks of discharge, which is when you really need to see them. And we're very lucky where I work that we've developed a what we call our sort of ward-based ambulatory care unit. So we have a system where recently discharged patients can come back to the ward, to this ambulatory care area, and see the same care team that discharged them. And we can check their urea and electrolytes. We can check how their ascites is going. We can re-prescribe the rifaximin if needs be, if they were discharged on that, check them for HE, et cetera, and so on. And when we did that, we noticed there was a dramatic reduction in readmissions. And just on that, we have two liver nurses who are absolutely superb and all over the complications, and they will ring patients up at home and make sure they're okay. So I think the multidisciplinary team is really important, but the GP is also part of that multidisciplinary team. And I think that, you know, unfortunately, the GPs are under a lot of pressure at the moment, so it's quite difficult for them to be able to provide timely follow-up for these often rather complex patients. So I think the team needs to be led from the hospital hepatology department. Nurses are absolutely critical. And it's interesting, if you look around the world, there's various models where people have used hospital nurses going out into the community, visiting patients at home, use day hospital setups for patients with cirrhosis to come back at short notice if needs be. And some of those models have been successful and some of them haven't. So I think you probably have to develop your local service depending on what skill set you have and what the needs of your patients are.
I guess Australia is a very vast country, and so we do have a large proportion of our population who are served by our regional and rural hospitals, and quite often very much healthcare resource restrained settings. So, Arvik, if I can go ask you, what can clinicians in those settings do to look after patients with cirrhosis, and what sort of assistance can be provided for them?
Basically, as you say, the healthcare certainly fragments as you get more rural and remotely in Australia. We're a state service at the Austin. We look after patients from Victoria and Tasmania in terms of eligibility for liver transplantation and their follow-up care. And so we do have quite extensive links and are aware of some of the issues that rural and remote clinicians face. Number one is, you know, again, the extreme pressure on limited healthcare services, and the clinicians, the caregivers, the nurses are all under a lot of strain due to the large increasing population of patients with liver disease. And secondly, the limited resources that might be available. I think nowadays, particularly post-COVID with the advent of telehealth, I think that has been helpful in this situation, particularly for us managing patients in Tasmania. We've often done joint consultations with their local physician if there's no gastroenterologist on site, or with their GP in terms of regional Victoria. And that's certainly been helpful in monitoring for advanced complications or monitoring the effect of therapies that might not be available in that town. Or even simple things like, where would you go with the diuretic dose? You know, as mentioned about initiating or continuing rifaximin, they're all things that can be advised very easily in a joint telehealth conversation.
James, would you have anything to add from a Queensland perspective?
Well, telehealth makes a difference. It really does. It often depends on patients having the right technology, but actually getting the telehealth with the GP out in the rural or remote areas is really important. And I do wonder whether this is going to be where we really see the impact of apps that are in development for remote sort of monitoring and self-care. And, you know, we've seen papers on people having Bluetooth enabled scales so that when they weigh themselves, it records it in an app that then can transmit to the liver a care nurse at the central hospital who can monitor people's weights remotely. And I think that's probably where the future's going. I often find that the GPs out in regional and rural areas are absolutely fantastic and are only more than willing to help if they can engage with a specialist. And of course, it means if you have a dedicated hepatology nursing team who can be contacted by phone or email, that makes it a lot more easy as well to manage these patients remotely. I think that patient education, care education is even more important for patients who aren't going to be able to just to come back to their primary centre when they're needed. But it's difficult. But people, just because they choose to live in regional or remote areas, shouldn't receive any lesser standard of care than people who live in metro areas. That's my feeling. We talk about multidisciplinary teams and nurses and alcohol liaison is all really, really important. But I actually think one of the most underutilized members of the multidisciplinary team is actually pharmacists. We have, especially as patients get much more complicated on multiple drugs, medicines reconciliation and de-prescribing, I think, are really important tenets of the management of these very complicated patients. And I would desperately love to get a pharmacist on my multidisciplinary team.
Now, along with the team of clinicians, we should, of course, not forget the role of the caregiver and family in all of this. How do you go about engaging the caregivers into the care of patients with chronic liver disease?
Oh, that's a really good point. And often we're guilty, I think, as medical teams of not considering the impact that chronic liver disease and the complications of chronic liver disease can have on the caregivers. This is a very difficult situation for people to be living with at home. And in fact, that's particularly pertinent for hepatic encephalopathy, where, you know, studies have shown that the impact in terms of quality of life on the caregivers is as bad as the impact on the quality of life for the patients who are suffering the disease. So we often forget about that. And I think that engaging with the caregiver in the clinic or in the hospital ward, finding out what their specific care needs are, what support they may need, is really important. And these are the people where we really need to focus our education, looking for early signs of deterioration, pointing out the signs of worsening hepatic encephalopathy or what to look for in terms of fluid retention. And the caregivers can be our early warning system, if you will. And if you've got a team of connected nurses who are connected with those caregivers, that gives people a fast track back into the hospital for either care or advice.
Well, thank you so much, both James and Arvik. This has been an absolutely fantastic discussion. I might just throw back to each of you in turn, just a quick summary as to any pertinent take-home points that you'd like our listeners to go home with. Perhaps, Arvik, if I can get you to start off.
I think the take-home points are that decompensated cirrhosis carries up high mortality and extremely high morbidity. These are patients that once they are on that cycle of representation that continues, recognize the precipitants early, start your treatment early, and also consider the bigger picture for the patient, so whether they need transplantation referral or not. And there's lots of management that can be instilled, and a lot of it's multidisciplinary.
I would echo everything that Avik said, but I think that really, if you know, we have to be cognizant of the fact that the rates of decompensated cirrhosis are increasing across the country, and this is driven by the twin epidemics of alcohol-related liver disease and metabolic-related liver disease, and we really need to start intervening at a public health level on those two twin threats if we're really going to make a difference. Even if we can't prevent people developing cirrhosis, as Avik mentioned, we can certainly look at preventing them getting decompensation, and that means screening for portal hypertension and treating it early prior to the onset of complications.
That's fantastic. Thanks very much, James, and thank you, Avik. It's been an absolutely fantastic discussion, and I've learned quite a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before prescribing, please review TGA-approved Xifaxan product information. Product information is available from the TGA website at www.tga.gov.au/resources/ARTG. Please note the following PBS information for Xifaxan, Rifaximin, authority required, prevention of hepatic encephalopathy. See pbs.gov.au/medicine/item/10001J. The product information and substantiating references can also be obtained from the DriveTime Radio website. This interview was supported by Norgine and produced in November 2024. The statements, conclusions, and opinions contained in this interview are those of the participating spokesperson and not necessarily those of the supporting organisation nor DriveTime Radio Australia Proprietary Limited.